All right, it's the Bon Appetit Foodcast. I'm Adam Rappaport. On today's show, Las Vegas. We were out there a few weeks ago. Andrew Knowlton and I were supposed to interview Wolfgang Puck in celebration of Spago's 25 years in Vegas, but like 5 minutes before the interview started, one of his assistants came in and said, Wolfgang had to fly back to Los Angeles for a family emergency. I don't know what happened. I hope everything's fine. But we were sort of left hanging out there like, what do we do now? So I interviewed Andrew about the 30 plus years he's been going to Vegas. And then Carl Lally Music, she sits down with the two hot tamales, Susan Feniger and Mary Sue Milliken, to talk about their nearly 40 years together, all in honor of our Vegas Uncorked Food Festival at Bon Appetit, which is in year number 11. This episode is presented by Chase Sapphire Reserve. Travel, dine, and enjoy, and get rewarded for it. Travel is changing. Carry the only card designed to stay ahead. That's Chase Sapphire Reserve. All right, let's do this thing.
Andrew, first time you ever came to Vegas?
The first time I ever came to Las Vegas was in 1984. I was 10 years old. My father was I wouldn't say he was a gambler, but he liked to play blackjack. And I remember as a kid going into his office and there'd be tons of blackjack books because he would like study blackjacks. And I knew we were going to Vegas because he would always start pulling them down off the shelf and like reading the strategy and all that. We came out, the three of us, my mom, myself, and my father, and we always stayed at one of two places. We stayed at Bally's, which was like, that was the place to stay. But then I think when my dad discovered Caesar's Palace, that was the place. And it's much smaller footprint than it is now. I think it was just the main kind of entrance, and then it had one tower. It wasn't even a tower, really. It was just four or five floors. There was none of the Augustus Tower or anything else going on.
Yeah, it's massive now. When you see it from afar, you think of it as one hotel, but it's basically like four hotels in one now.
It's like city blocks, and before it was just like a little corner. And there was only three or four restaurants that I remember there. There was Cleopatra's Barge, which is still at Caesar's Palace.
you would think, like, maybe the name Cleopatra's Barge, we should rebrand that.
Is that
the one next to Nobu now? Where you actually
The boat comes out onto into the walkway. Yeah. And it used to be a place where my parents would go dancing, like, late into the evening. And I love my parents, and they were good parents.
Disclaimer.
But I vividly remember that they would say, we're going to the barge, and they would take me. My mom would
Did they literally say, Andrew, we're going to the barge?
Well, they would say, we're going to the boat place, because I loved the boat place.
And it's kind of like a jazz bar
I think it used to be. I mean, this was in the 80s, so there was probably some ABBA going on. It was probably disco back in the day. But I couldn't go because everything was 21.
Yeah.
And we would have to like scurry across the casino floor, and my mom would probably stop and play slots for a minute, and then the security guard would come through and be like, Mish, you can't have your kid on the casino floor.
So would they just leave you in the room and you'd order room service or what?
So my mom would take me back to the room and would say, if you have any problems, just call the front desk and tell them that your parents are at Cleopatra's Barge. Can you imagine doing that today?
I can because, listen, I'm a few years older than you, and, like, I never wore a seatbelt growing up. I never wore a helmet on a bike. I mean, the notion of wearing a helmet on a bicycle, like, what? Like, you know, parenting was very different back then. Just watch Bad News Bears when Walter Matthau is driving around with nine kids in his car and an open beer with whiskey in the beer, you know? So would you guys go out to dinner beforehand, before they just deposited you?
Well, I think back then there wasn't, you know, Spago had opened at the Forum Shops.
Had just opened.
That was not something you came to Las Vegas to do. You came to gamble.
Yes.
And you came to see, like, boxing matches, you know, fights. That
and
was
a show.
And a show.
You would see Wayne Newton, maybe.
You'd see Wayne Newton. I don't remember ever going to any show like that. I remember going to buffets. I remember going to the Bally's Buffet and thinking it was the greatest place in the world. They had coconut shrimp. Ooh. And I would just load my plate with coconut shrimp. That was exotic, man. Coconut shrimp.
I still will load my plate with coconut shrimp.
With the sweet and sour sauce on the side.
So good.
But my most fond memory of Las Vegas was maybe a couple years afterwards. I think maybe my father was coming out here for conventions. So I remember there was this, it's still here, but I'm not sure it retains its glory, but it's called Circus Circus.
Oh, yes. Yes. As featured in which James Bond film? Was it Diamonds Are Forever or...
Was it in Diamonds Are Forever?
Or Spy Who Loved Me? I think Diamonds Are Forever.
So Circus was... It was a circus. And it was a circus, like, theme. And they had a really good steakhouse called The Steakhouse. And it's legendary.
Am I mistaken in saying that there were, like, performers
at Circus? Yes. Yeah, they were all walking around. It was, like, it was the best place. But they had this arcade. And this is, like, the height of arcade-ness.
This is, like, Miss Pac-Man era.
Yes. So my mom would, you know, back in Atlanta where I'm from, every Saturday, like, I would get dropped off at Perimeter Mall and I would take whatever money I had and I would play Galaga and Centipede and Donkey Kong for, like, 8 hours. Yeah. And then they would come pick us up. But Circus had this arcade, and it was like you died and gone to arcade heaven. I mean, they had this game called Dragon Slayer. Do you ever remember?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it was like the first kind of point of view video game. Anyway, so I remember my mom taking me into the arcade, giving me $50 in quarters.
Shut up.
Rolled quarters.
No, she did not give you $50.
She did. And they left.
I didn't leave my 10-year-old unattended
left,
in the
they
casino.
They left. But then I met other kids there whose parents had done the same thing. And I didn't even know. Like, my mom just said, don't leave the arcade. And I didn't leave. It was 1985, 86, you know? Didn't matter. So I remember that was probably the greatest day of my life.
My first trip to Vegas, so I came in that next wave in 1997, I want to say. Yeah, 97, 98, when I was at Time Out in New York. And Bellagio had just opened.
Okay.
And our mutual friend Elizabeth Blau was head of restaurant development there. And she was the one who brought in Le Cirque and Jean Georges mm-hmm. to open his steakhouse. And it was the first sort of kind of real concerted wave of high dining. You know, Spago had opened back in the day. Right. And then Jean-Louis Paladin
had a place
at Rio, but it was kind of like off on its own little thing. And Steve Wynn was the first guy to really promote, you know.
That was a game changer.
A game changer. Yeah. And I came out, so I kind of drummed up some reason for a press trip to go do an article. And so Adam Sachs, our mutual friend, editor Sever, and Brett Martin, the fine writer, all piled into a room together, came out here for 3 days. And as a 24-year-old, or maybe I was 27, I don't know. It was just like that first trip to Vegas, you're like, wow, I can't believe this place actually exists.
That was the first time you'd ever been
there? Yeah, the first time I'd ever been. And what's interesting, like I said, Bellagio sort of started the new wave of Vegas. You know, it was the Venetian and Palazzo did not exist. Hard Rock was just opening. That was a lot of fun as a youngster. But, you know, now it's fascinating. You know, everyone from Gordon Ramsay to Bobby Flay to Nobu.
Giada.
They're all, you have to, you know, and Guy Savoy and all the French mission, Joël Robuchon. It was interesting getting in that sort of ground floor of what Vegas is now. And you pointed out about how you used to come to Vegas to gamble. And I think if you look at statistics, the vast majority of the revenue for these resort casinos was from gaming.
Absolutely.
And now that scale has tipped. And now it's entertainment and dining that's sort of the driving force.
I heard it was 70% now. 70% comes from the entertainment aspect, whether that's restaurants or going to shows or whatever.
Or clubs or the DJs, and that's just massive business right
now.
Much
bigger than Cleopatra's barge.
Yes. So we're in this new Vegas, which you know, we come here every year for our Vegas Uncorked Festival. And then before that, which is now 6 years straight for me, before that, when I was at GQ, I would come for Magic, which is a men's apparel show, twice a year, which is kind of insane, both summer and winter. So you definitely sort of get into rhythm. In terms of, let's talk some of your strategy for eating well and surviving in Vegas. What's your breakfast routine? Are you a room service guy?
Well, now that they have juice in Vegas, at
finally.
Least you feel you can like go and get a nice. I'm not trying to act like I'm some healthy, but man, after a rough night, you need a juice.
Right now we're staying at Venetian, but here at Caesars, you now start seeing juice press in these juiceries. And honestly, I was surprised it took this long for those places to open in Vegas, given Vegas's proximity to LA and the LA crowd. And that sort of morning after refresher.
Right. And just healthy eating in general. There's options now. I'm not a huge breakfast person in general. I'm not a room service person. I know you are, Adam. But for somebody, you complain all the time about how nobody gets room service right, but then you always get it, which I don't understand.
It's like that thing of like going out into the world before you've had your coffee. It's just nice, although it is funny. Like yesterday I was like, can I get a pot of coffee and then some toast with a side of avocado? And a club soda, and it's $46. And you're like, wow, okay. Do I tip on this? Does that, what does that gratuity included mean? Does that go to you? And then there's gratuity included, and then there's the service charge. You're right. Like, wait, what? Like,
but what year do you think you could call room service and get avocado toast? Is that a recent thing?
Yeah, I think so. And I said, you know, I get a side of, so a couple of pieces of like multigrain toast and a side of avocado. And I will say the avocado was excellent. Perfectly ripe, fanned out really nicely. And I got some lime with the club soda. So then I did the little lime squeeze with some salt and chopped it up. And it was a good breakfast. And then I went to the gym. And like I said, I think that's an important thing in Vegas, as indulgent as you can be. I always make sure I go to the gym every day.
Absolutely.
Just to keep the blood going.
I think it's the same thing when I'm traveling, you know, around the country to find the best restaurants for our September restaurant issue. I have to be able to, I need that energy, and all I'm going to be doing is eating. So you need to do that, whether it's in Vegas or on the road. You've got to like get your exercise in, because it'll make you feel so much better. But my game plan for lunch, kind of breakfast lunch, is I'm a huge proponent of poolside eating. I think going to the pool, getting a club sandwich, getting a quesadilla, getting a frozen drink that you would never order anywhere else,
yes,
except in Vegas. That's my, if I come to Vegas and I don't do that, I haven't done it right.
Although I will say this, so yeah, as you know me, anytime I travel at a hotel, I have to get the club sandwich religiously. I have an issue with the one on offer yesterday. My feeling of a club, I don't know. Like, I think a club sandwich should be a turkey club sandwich. They put ham and Swiss cheese with the turkey and bacon. And I found that, why do you need ham with bacon? And then also, why do you put a cheese on a turkey?
Have you ever, because you complain a lot about club sandwiches. Yeah. Have you ever had a good club sandwich?
I've had many good club sandwiches. Okay. Especially, I think the better club sandwiches are often like at diners and such. Let's talk steakhouses. I think when a lot of people come to Vegas, they're like, oh, I gotta at least go to a steakhouse one night. Do you have any favorites or preferences?
Well, I think of the old school ones, I think we're in agreement that I love Golden Steer. It's
which is off strip.
Off strip. It's a classic. I think it's been around since the 40s. We've written about it in Bon Appetit a few times. It's whatever you conjure as your old school steakhouse, that's what it is. It's got tableside Caesar salad,
tableside flambé desserts.
Flambé. You can get like, you know, whatever. You can get prime rib. You can get a skirt steak or strip steak.
Yeah. And they've got these great tufted black leather banquettes.
Right. And the waiters have been there since 1944 or something.
And it's interesting, it's also one of those places, there's so many places in Vegas that claim to have been Rat Pack hangouts, but like, you know, Frank and Dino, those guys actually did go to the theater. And also great bar scene there also, or at least a great bar.
And the neon on the outside is amazing.
So I would highly recommend that. I think on Strip, we're both a fan of Wolfgang Puck's Cut
Absolutely.
Restaurant. You know, not cheap.
No, well, not steakhouses in Las Vegas. You don't come here to nickel and dime when you go to steakhouse. But I think of the new ones, I think Strip Steak is good. That's at MGM.
I think what's interesting about Cut, and you see that, it was one of the first steakhouses to do this, which you see a lot more of now, where they break down each steak by how many days it's been aged, what ranch it came from.
What it's been fed.
Yeah, and you can get, whether it's grass or grain, do you want 32, do you want 48J, you know, and prices that are commensurate to
If you want 2 ounces of Wagyu Japanese beef, you can get it here, and it'll cost you $250 an ounce.
they will facilitate you.
But that's another strategy I think that's important to point out is, if you come to Las Vegas a lot, I think, you know, move around to the different resorts and stay there, because waiting in taxi lines here is no fun.
No.
So I think every resort has great restaurants. Like, stay at Caesars, stay at the Palazzo, stay at Cosmopolitan, and just explore those restaurants.
Well, it's fascinating, I think, you know, just the quality of restaurants. I mean, you're at Cosmopolitan now. Momofuku just opened there. Jose Andres, we had dinner at Haleo the other night with our writer friend Jason Gay. He has his Sheena Polano. Is that his other one there?
Yeah.
Jose does. You know, at Aria, they've got Carbone now. You know, just walking through Caesars, just the number of, you know, from Nobu on down, it's kind of incredible the number of quality restaurant options
right,
you have here.
Right. And you know, it used, you know, 15 years ago was such a new thing, and all the big name chefs were coming here. And now I think they've settled into this groove where the consistency is there. Like, you very rarely do you have just a bad meal in Las Vegas now.
Yeah.
Because there's so many. We complain in New York and LA about how there's just not a lot of talent out there for chefs. Like, they can't fill their restaurants. Here, these are professionals. These are lifelong restaurant people who are This is what they do.
They know how to execute. Yeah. And it's also nice about Vegas. You can get into places.
Yes, you can.
There are so many restaurants, and the restaurants are of a much bigger size than in most cities. So you have options. You have accessibility. Let's talk late night. In-N-Out Burger just opened on the Strip here at The Link.
With The Link.
There had been an In-N-Out off-Strip with a ginormous sign. Do you ever go to In-N-Out when you're in Vegas?
I don't. I'm not an In-N-Out guy.
What?
No, I'm not. I'm an East Coast guy. I think the bun is an inferior product.
Wow.
And I think when you have to ask a place to do your fries well done, like that's the secret order, I don't buy it. I will eat it, but it's not something, give me Waffle House, give me Chick-fil-A, give me Shake Shack.
Okay, well, first of all, you're wrong. Second of all, listen, the double-double is unimpeachable as a burger. I will give you the fries. I mean, years ago, I remember waking up after a really rough night, and we went to In-N-Out. And like, so this must have been like noon by the time we got up, waited in line. It was like a 45-minute wait. That was the best bite of food I might have ever had in my
life. That saved your life.
Yeah, I mean, like that hungover morning, waiting for that double-double and the giant Coke, and you're just like, oh my God.
Thank you,
America.
That's not good judgment for something tasting good when you're hungover and all you want
is. No, but it was better than like the random like going to the buffet or whatever. It was. It's like, listen, you like you,
crab legs.
You know what you're reacting to? You're reacting to all the love that In-N-Out gets.
I will give you that I did not grow up with In-N-Out. There's no sentimental, you know, feelings for that place. I have no longing for it. It's fine. It's a decent burger. Let's move on.
Who are you more excited for, the Golden Knights or the Las Vegas Raiders?
I cannot support the Las Vegas Raiders.
Really?
I cannot get behind the move of the Raiders to Las Vegas. So I will support the hockey team, which is still weird too, though.
The Golden Knights. All right, before we let you go, speaking of moves, a couple more off-strip moves. If you're coming to Vegas and you're staying at a fun resort property, you're hanging out at the pool, you're dining at the restaurants, but you want to get off-strip, a couple of restaurants you might recommend.
So the old school one that everyone talks about is Lotus of Siam, which is this Thai restaurant that you can name how hot you want your food, basically 1 through 10. And they have amazing Riesling list, wine list. That's kind of the OG. But now on this strip of road, it's just 10 minutes from the strip called Spring Mountain. Mm-hmm. It's basically this international row of restaurants. You have amazing, you have Raku, which is this Japanese restaurant.
Went there with you. And you get a lot more of the kind of the grilled sort
izakaya, of, yeah, teppanyaki type stuff. And then there's numerous sushi places over there. There's good pho here. There's Korean food. I just think if you come to Vegas, give yourself one night to get off the strip. This is the food that a lot of the people who work in the resorts and the communities around here, and you very rarely do you get local kind of vibes, and you get that on Spring Mountain.
Yeah, and you can check out some of our recommendations on the Bon Appetit City Guide, right?
That's right.
We have a city guide for Las Vegas on bonappetit.com. Check that out. Well, Angie Knowlton, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Can I just apologize to my parents again? Sorry.
See ya.
All right, this episode is presented by Chase Sapphire Reserve. Travel, dine, enjoy, and get rewarded for it. Travel is changing. Carry the only card designed to stay ahead. That's Chase Sapphire Reserve. All right, that was Andrew Knowlton and me. And now here is Carla Lolly Music with Susan Fenniger and Mary Sue Milliken.
All right, well, I can't actually believe that I'm sitting across the table from the two of you. I'm here with Mary Sue Milliken and Susan Fenniger, also known as the Two Hot Tamales. And I just have to say that when you guys first had your show on the Food Network, which was a very new thing, I was a student at the French Culinary Institute going to school to, you know, become a line cook, and I worshipped you. Oh. And I have to say also that show, it's hard for people now to remember or understand, but that was a show that was like on television at a certain time that you had to turn the TV on to be able to watch it. You know, there was no TiVo, DVR, there was no like iTunes. It was like, get your butt in the chair and turn on the TV. And I just looked forward to it so much. I thought you guys were the best.
All of our fans were insomniacs because it played a lot in the middle of the night.
Is that right?
Really. And it, don't talk about how long ago, because that, yeah, before TiVo and that, that really dates
makes
us
feel
I know.
Old.
Well, I was there, guys. Like, I was just sort of starting out in the food world, and there were still very few women chefs. There were not a lot of women on TV. And also, right. Food Network back then, it was less about competition and more about cooking instruction.
Oh, yeah. It was nothing about, at that point, it was nothing about competition. It was really about education. About
I loved
learning
the
and
ethos
teaching.
In the beginning yeah. of Food Network because they said they were never going to rerun any shows. It was like fresh food in your refrigerator. They didn't want to have it, you know, once it aired, they didn't want to re-air it.
Interesting.
The guy who created it, Reese Schoenfeld.
Yep.
That was his idea.
And we were doing, back then, we were doing 6 shows a day, 5 days a week.
Stop. And it was filming where?
In New York. On 6th Avenue.
And had you had a lot of television broadcast experience before that?
We'd had some. We had already done Julia. We had done cooking.
Yeah, but
we'd
that,
done cooking with Master Chefs with Julia and Chefs of the West. And
Chefs of the West. Boy, you watched. That was the first one we ever did.
Yeah.
And when I see myself on that, I would really think, oh my gosh, I was so nervous.
Yeah. We hadn't done a lot, but we had done a little bit.
Yeah.
But that was like a huge education, I would imagine, in just, you know, coming up through the years of that evolution too.
Yeah.
And it was really, I was saying this, that our producer of the show, she lived in New York. She had taken her kitchen out of her apartment, and she smoked cigarettes and drank Coke.
And she was about 85 pounds.
Wow.
But she was adorable.
Did you turn her into a convert, or that was...
I don't think so.
I like to think we did, but not sure.
No, but it was a different time of Food Network. But the shows were definitely, it was about teaching people.
Totally.
100%.
Yeah, I used to watch Sarah Moulton too,
right.
And she would, it was literally half an hour. It was live in real time, and she pushed through.
Yeah,
there was no
David
magic.
Rose,
yep, totally.
We all had really the same exact set. So they would change it for Bobby at like a different color for us, a different color for Emerald. But every single other thing of the set was exactly the same.
Yeah.
Mario, you know, I'd come in and I'd be like, oh God, there's a map of Italy there.
Oh.
You know, he's not going to do the show today. It's me and Susan.
That's so funny. Yeah, but you guys have been famous for forever. I mean, it was really like thinking about it, you've been famous longer than Madonna, I think.
No, but I do remember, you know, it's funny. When we opened City Restaurant in 1985, we'd already had our other little cafe for 4 years, and Bon Appetit did a huge story about us. And literally, we both looked so tired. But the article's so great. And I remember when they came in and we were so tired and they took all these photos and they didn't care. Bon Appetit didn't care. They just ran the article. It was sort of a real slice of life.
Yeah.
And then we got an article on the front of the LA Times magazine shortly after that. And Madonna actually used to eat in the restaurant quite often. But I didn't even know it, I think, because we were working so hard. And I walked out of the front door one night and all these paparazzi took pictures. And I thought to myself, wow, is that just from the LA Times magazine? But Madonna was behind me.
You're like, we made it.
Yeah.
And then I felt so stupid, like, oh my God.
Well, that's the thing about LA sometimes is like even the people who aren't celebrities are famous for doing things for the celebrities, you know? So you have a celebrity dentist and all the celebrities go to him and then
exciting.
He's famous too.
I love it. You know, we're both from the Midwest.
Yeah.
But when I first moved out to LA, and I started working at Ma Maison. Mm. That was when Wolf was the chef there. And I remember the valet guy, the guy who parked the cars there. There were two of them. I would be so starstruck. I had just moved from Chicago, which is where Mary Sue and I met.
Right.
I would be so starstruck. He would come back and say, okay, that's Orson Welles' car.
Wow.
That's Jane Fonda's car. That's Paul Newman's car. Of course, and I would call home that night. You know who was in? And it was just, you know, it's an interesting thing to be in Los Angeles, especially if you're, I think, from the Midwest or if you're starstruck. It's very exciting, even still for me now when people come into the restaurant. I love it.
Yeah. So let's go back to the Midwest when you guys met, because part of your what's so remarkable about your career is the partnership, I think, and that, you know, you have made it happen and you've been together as a team for such a long time, which is rare in, you know, I mean, it's almost like you could barely expect that from family and marriages for sure. Yeah. So you were in Chicago and you were both cooking. And did you meet in a restaurant?
At Le Perroquet.
Okay. Yeah.
Which was probably, I think for both of us, we've said probably the best restaurant we ever worked at.
Wow.
The owner was amazing.
Really?
We learned a ton. The food was way ahead of its time. We learned, even there we learned, as line cooks, we learned so much about food cost. Not so specific, but about watching cost, about using, we used to save the wrappers from the butter when we were clarifying butter, and we would use that wrapper to cover the pastry cream.
Or we would skim the chicken's fat off the chicken stock or the duck fat off the duck stock, and we would render it and purify it and make it perfect. And then we'd use, if we got an order in for a duck
breast, anything poultry,
we'd use duck fat or chicken, we'd use chicken. So, you know, it was sort of, for us and for me growing up as a child of a mother who was a depression era baby, it kind of all made sense to me.
Right.
But, you know, our world has gone a little bit way too far off of that
idea. With wastefulness.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, totally.
We used everything. Like every day at lunch, we ran a scallop dish. So this is now 30 something years ago and we still remember.
Right.
This.
Yeah.
And we, 40 years ago. Oh my God. We're old. But, you know.
No, you're not old. You're legends.
Yes, yeah.
You don't get to be a legend unless you're, like, on the scene for a long time. You know what I mean?
We would do this scallop dish, and in the center was a vegetable mousse only made from whatever stems of whatever vegetables we were using.
So broccoli stems, watercress stems, cauliflower stems. So it was all used, like every single
thing. Isn't that so funny how all of these old techniques, which were based on a scarcity of food, that now, you know, we go into like overconsumption and, you know, processed food. And then now I feel like everybody's coming back to this and it's all about waste and reusing and local. And it's like not a new, it's not
no,
new.
No, no,
it's old.
It is. Yeah.
These are really
and
old
in
ideas.
In fact, some kinds of food, some of the most exciting and delicious kinds of food were born out of that scarcity. Like, you know, we don't have anything to eat, so make squid guts taste good.
Right.
You know, that's like
figure
a Japanese
it out.
Thing.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And they did.
Salt this cod because we're going to need it in 3 or 4 months.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's amazing. So when you met, did you have a moment of like, this is, I think, like, I just want to be your friend forever? Did you know then how much you would impact each other's lives?
No. We were both sort of still at the beginning of our career.
Sure.
I mean, or the middle of it. We'd both gone to culinary school. We both worked in restaurants. I'd come from Kansas City working for a great guy there at a French restaurant. Came to Chicago. And it was sort of just within our career. We were the only two women in the kitchen.
I was going to ask if there were any other women.
No. I was the first woman he hired. And I had to sort of lobby him for 6 weeks to get that job. And I literally cried and stamped my feet and called him every day and sent letters. And finally he was like, are you going to sue me? I said, no, I just want to work there. And he said, okay, come in tomorrow, $3.25 an hour. And you can peel the shallots. And then Susan came by a couple months later and he hired her on the spot. So he obviously thought, wow, I pay her half as much as the boys and she works twice as hard. I'll take another.
And
when
the chef ended up going on vacation, Mary Sue and I ran the kitchen.
Yeah.
So and it was a really wonderful kitchen, and we both learned a ton.
But I think from the minute I met Susan, I felt like I just thought I hadn't met anybody in the kitchen, mm-hmm. male or female, who had the same work ethic as me, who had the same drive, the same passion, the same attention to detail, like, you know, and she taught me a lot. I taught her. I mean, we were definitely pretty quickly each other's support system.
Right.
For sure. Well, the chef was picking on me a ton.
Yeah.
And, you know, it would be something like he'd tell you how to do one thing that morning and then the next day, and you'd write it down in your notebook and next day you'd come back and then he would yell at me for doing it that way. And we'd take like a afternoon break and I'd go in the bathroom and I'd be like just tears. Like, I cannot stand it here. And Mary Sue would be, no, just stay.
Just
you gotta
stick it
stay.
Out.
Just stick it. He was such a jerk. But we did learn an absolute ton. And the lesson in all that is that many years later, we were doing consulting for Caroline's Comedy Club in New York. Mm-hmm. And he came in to interview for the job for the executive chef position.
Wow.
And we were involved with the hiring.
We got to hire him. We did hire him. And we got to set his salary. And we got to do, it was fabulous.
Oh, that is amazing.
Really
did his jaw drop when he saw you?
And it must have at some point. That's the fabulous thing about our world is I think, you know, many people know each other. Every time we get resumes in, I tell all of our managers, let us see them.
Right.
We probably know someone who that person worked for and
sure.
can make a call. And you get a completely different reference check from someone you know.
Right. But I think you guys are also special in that the hands-on nature of how you operate in both the outward-facing and running the restaurants. I mean, we did an event with you yesterday, and Alex, who's sitting right by my side, just came from an event with you today. And you guys are, you're in it. You're like hands-on, face-to-face, super fans everywhere. And did that come naturally also, or is that something that, like, at the end of the day, you go home and put noise-canceling headphones on and, like, close the curtains? It's like, I'm done.
Well. That does sound kind of good.
I mean, it does. It for sure, it comes naturally. I think we both have always felt like it's the hospitality business. I remember at our very first staff meeting for City Restaurant, with all of these employees, the first time we'd had a big staff. And I remember us saying to the staff is like, look, only thing that's important is that the customer gets what they want. That it's, we don't have attitude, doesn't matter how busy we are. You have to be sweet, no attitude. And it's something that I feel like we've sort of carried through with our restaurants, managers, to the team who they work with and to our customers. It's that, you respect the dishwasher as much as the director of operations.
Which is really interesting because, you know, coming from my first couple jobs were with a French chef who had come from Le Cirque and before that in France. And there wasn't, that was non-existent. And I think the culture of restaurants in that era was much more about, you know, pay your dues, suffer, toil, cry in the walk-in, like whatever it takes. And then also the guest experience was very much like this very formal experience. The cook stayed in the kitchen. You know, you didn't have that. So that was just something that just evolved for you. You wanted that vibe. I mean, that I'm just saying, was that something you experienced in the restaurants you worked at or something that you wanted to create for your own?
It was a new era. You know, we left Chicago and we both went to France and worked separate. I worked in Paris at a 2-star restaurant, Susan in the south of France at a 3-star restaurant. Then we decided to come back after a year or so, and we kept in touch quite a lot. And then I went to Chicago. We were both broke, and she went to L.A. But eventually we were going to open our own restaurant. And she said, come to L.A. We can do it here. And, you know, by that time, things were in our industry were just starting to change. Mm-hmm. I mean, little by little. We had the menu on the blackboard every day at City Cafe. But then when we opened City Restaurant 4 years later at 85, we had a TV camera, a closed-circuit TV camera at the bar, which so showed you what we were doing in the kitchen.
Oh, wow.
So sometimes we would do crazy things in the kitchen, like we had a rubber duck.
Oh, my goodness.
We had, you know, we'd take a big salmon and we'd take it toward the camera.
With a squirt gun in the mouth. And we also, you know, it was a time where we were exploring what our food passion was. All of our training was in French kitchens.
Right.
And I think we were both very drawn to country French dishes, for sure. I mean, I think things like cassoulet. And mm-hmm. the restaurant where we worked at, Le Perroquet, did a number of things like brandade and cassoulet and confit and pot-au-feu. So all of a sudden, instead of things that were like beurre blanc and that, we were really drawn to this.
And also then, ethnic food, you know, fell right into it, like Greek food and Italian and things that were, you know, even Thai food and Indian food. That's really when all of our tastes started to change when Susan took her first trip to India.
Yeah, because we opened City Cafe and our menu was sort of, you know,
French.
Yeah, country French. And then I took my first trip to India and came back home. And then it was like, okay, we need to do this vegetable fritter.
And
it took
Susan all day to do it. She was like peeling fenugreek pods
outside.
And I was like, you know, we're going to have to find another way to do this because our labor, we don't have enough people.
That was in, you know, like 82, we put this vegetarian plate dish on the menu that was so time consuming.
Right.
Literally, it had like a dal, a curry, you know,
it was like a thali platter.
Chutney, exactly. All these different vegetables prepared, different ways.
But not all Indian.
Yeah.
But some of them were maybe
like
Mediterranean.
A sour eggplant.
Right.
And then, so we started to incorporate onto the menu, like the potato budgie or the vegetable fritter with the minced cilantro chutney and another curry. And then Mary Sue took her first trip to Thailand, came back. And then we did like the Thai melon salad, the Chinese sausage. So now our menu is reading confit, cassoulet, Thai melon, blah, blah, blah. So when we went to open that next, and when we went to open City Restaurant, our next restaurant, we decided we should put a tandoori oven in. Neither one of us had ever worked with a tandoori oven.
But you had to have one.
We had to have one.
This is the perfect picture. It would be so great if we had had video of this. Of the getting the tandoori, though.
Yeah.
Picking
it up.
We got it. We borrowed a pickup truck. We went down to this hotel owned by this Indian guy in downtown LA. He had these unfired tandooris, like a 30 non-tandoori. And so it's just clay.
Right.
It's green. Hasn't been fired. So it's very
hair
fragile.
All through it. And
super
I was
brittle.
In the back of the truck holding the tandoori while Mary Sue was riding through the streets of LA. Because if it wasn't fired, so it would.
Yeah, it just shatter.
And that, so this is now 85. Yeah. So we're in there. We're trying to learn about how do you fire it because we had to get it passed by building and safety.
Right.
And so we spent like 15 hours or 13 hours firing. We wrapped towels all around our head and our arms and everything because you have to fire it at like 1,200 degrees.
For a long time.
Mustard oil and a brown sugar.
Wow.
And that's the glaze on the inside so the naan won't stick.
And we played Indian music and had incense. And we were firing.
We really blessed it.
All day long. And, you know, and goggles on.
Oh, my God.
It was, you know, 1,000 degrees. So you had to be in there, like, firing it. And we had that tandoori oven the whole time we were there. And it was cobalt blue and yellow. And so when the camera from the bar looked in, you saw this gorgeous cobalt blue and yellow tile.
Neat.
Tandoori oven. Mary Sue and I, the night before our opening party, Mary Sue and I were at the restaurant all night long. Trying to learn how to make naan.
It's embarrassing to think back because, you know, now before people open restaurants, they actually have family, friends and family services, and they do all this practice.
Soft open.
We were so broke. We had no money. We'd run over. We didn't have enough money raised anyway. And then we ran, you know, 6 weeks later.
And it's like, we need to start getting
customers. We just like open the doors. we don't have time to practice.
We slept on the rubber mats and then we woke up at like 5 in the morning with round circles.
Oh,
and
God.
Our first naan that came out of the oven that was like dripping like this.
So this was before you, now you're so closely associated with the flavors of Mexican cooking.
Right.
And would you say, you know, this is before.
And it was a,
this
well,
is
it was
before
kind of
that.
A natural kind of outcropping from being very global, really, and looking at food from all over the world at City and writing City Cuisine, which is our first cookbook. And I think we loved the Mexican kitchen so much because all of our staff is Mexican, a huge number of them. And they would make stuff for staff meal or, you know, for a treat, we would drive to East Melrose and get a Nelsie's Carnitas Tacos. And that's why we opened Border Grill on Melrose in 85 when we moved a little cafe to the bigger quarters.
We were trying to decide at that time, either we were going to do a taco stand or a noodle house.
Wow.
So that was 85.
Yeah. And you went taco stand.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or
I don't think the world was ready for our version of Momofuku. It would have, I don't know. That would have been a little too early, 85.
And but. So it's really interesting to me that the Mexican cooking came from the cooks in the kitchen in LA, which is like such an American, you know, story of that we're exposed to these other flavors without having to necessarily travel to eat authentic. And in LA too, I mean, you're spoiled for Mexican. Mm-hmm. My husband's from LA, so he always complains about you can't get a good taco in New York. It's true.
Yeah.
But so that exposure was really through the lens of your people, employees.
Especially being women mm-hmm. in French kitchens mm-hmm. where a lot of the Hispanic guys and women were doing prep and that, and we were, as women, ended up in that role. And so you'd see some, even in Chicago, you'd see some incredible staff meal being made like in 10 minutes and you'd taste it and be like, okay, you cannot get this food out.
And right. so much fresher and more vegetable centric and more delicious and bright flavored and tangy. You know, the Mexican food I was eating in East Lansing, Michigan when I was growing up was, you know, del taco, like sure. those crispy taco things right. with a lot of orange cheese and sour cream and, you know, it looked like a cumin-y blood.
It's
the ground
probably
beef.
Still that way in Lansing.
Probably.
I don't think so.
But, you know, but it was really, I think for us, we felt like there is a cuisine here mm-hmm. that we don't know that much about. It's worth us exploring. And we had one cook in our kitchen at City Cafe. We made the decision that we were going to turn it into a taqueria. We went to stay with his family in Mexico City to begin mm-hmm. and spent like 4 or 5 days with his mom going to the market, buying everything that we had no idea what it was,
right.
coming back to and, the house and cooking
tasting
with
all
her.
These things.
And yeah. then we traveled around, you know,
Puebla
Mexico.
And Veracruz. And then we got to Merida. And Yucatan had a huge influence on us in the very yeah. early days.
Yeah.
I mean, we'd never had a fish taco.
Right.
And we were standing in Valladolid, was it? Or Merida?
Merida.
In Merida, we were in front of this tiny little window. And there was all this amazing food. And this big guy was standing there with little tiny tortillas. We'd never even seen little tiny.
I mean, they were like 3 inches.
3 inches, okay.
And in his hand, there's like salmon there and shrimp.
And those bumpy skinned Seville oranges.
Yeah.
And we'd see him and he would like squeeze it on there. And then he took like the salmon with like
extra
a little bit of mayonnaise.
Olive oil.
Yeah, and peas and radishes and like this cucumber cabbage slaw. And he would put it and we would be like, oh my God, what is that? And we stood out there for like an hour
just
writing
watching
notes.
And
finally he came around with tacos and 2 little beers.
And he was like, he thought we were too poor to buy them. And we just kept watching. So then we went in and we thought, well, we got to spend some money. But he ended up inviting us back the next day for lunch.
And
when
he
made this beautiful lunch for us. And he didn't speak English. We
right.
didn't speak Spanish. I mean, we speak a little kitchen Spanish, which is like
right.
two nouns,
right.
or two verbs, I mean,
mm-hmm.
with
two
no conjugation.
Words.
Right.
Yeah.
No, like 20 swear words.
It's so, yeah, that's also, it's something that we think a lot about at the magazine as well, because we have the opportunity to work on, you know, foods from so many different cultures and places, and that food becomes this like vehicle for learning
yeah,
and
for
travel
sure.
and exploration. So I'm curious, like, how much you both feel indebted to some idea of an authentic Mexican cuisine, whether it's from the Yucatan or from Mexico City or wherever you are, and how much you feel like you can kind of play with those flavors and make, you know, do your own thing.
Well, that's definitely changed over time.
Yeah. yeah.
I think in the beginning, I felt, I think we both were just sort of like, okay, we've learned something fantastic. You know, maybe we had to gussy it up a little bit with French technique that mm-hmm. we were so good at, but it was basically exactly the way we found it. And we didn't make hardly any creative changes.
So you were basically trying to replicate the dishes you had tasted and seen
yes.
and had.
But
we were
adamant
about yeah. we want to do authentic food. We want to do what someone's grandmother or grandfather did and do it as well.
Right.
We don't want to just take an ingredient, put it on a piece of chicken, and have it be Mexican. I still sort of feel, I still feel that way.
Yeah.
I still feel like there's fabulous technique and ingredient and recipes that everybody can learn from.
Mm-hmm.
Now we do allow a little, I mean, now we accept a little bit more of sort of openness, as long as I think the ingredients are used in the right way.
And we're more mm-hmm. trained, you know, I mean, back then we'd only been cooking for 10 years, you
right.
know, and now we've been cooking for, you know, many 50. Decades.
Right.
And I think it really, you know, with that time comes a certain confidence and a certain
comfort.
You know, comfort
yeah.
to just play
right.
with the ingredients and play with the techniques and play with the ideas. And it's true though. you know, I see a lot of young upstarts playing and I think, oh, you should really, you might as well stick with the stuff that's tried and true until you get a little more footing.
Yeah.
So I mean, I think it's, you know, it's a little bit of understanding the, I think where what we gained the most from the training in French kitchens were techniques and how to cook. Because those techniques are the techniques that are used in so many kitchens.
Right. I know. I say this a lot. Like, there's only so many ways to cook things. Like, since maybe with the exception of sous vide, like, these are the methods, kind of been the methods since the beginning of, you know, cooking and recipes being recorded. There's just, there's not that many ways.
Right, and how to butcher and what cuts of meat to use for how you're cooking. So all those things are really important. And I think, you know, now there's much more ability to explore ingredients, whereas back then,
Much more rigid.
When we were in Mexico, we were seeing and learning about ingredients that you could never, that we just didn't even know how to explore then. Now, you know, you can go online and you can sort of understand a cuisine in a much more thorough way than, you know,
I feel like there's an upside and a downside to how available the information is. On the one hand, it's so amazing to be able to, we were just working on this, it's like a samosa, but a Bengali version of a samosa that had been submitted by one of our readers. And it had this very complicated folding technique and this triangle and a cone. And it's like, it was hard to know exactly how to do it. And it wasn't in books. And but you can go on YouTube and look that up and then immediately watch someone in their home, you know, demonstrating this technique. That's so cool. Like, you don't have to go travel to find that. And then on the other hand, it's like the romance of finding the little taco stand in the middle of nowhere instead of, you know, pre-researching every place you're going to go to and where you have to eat and the dish you have to take a picture of. And, you know, those things are, I don't know, it takes the specialness away a little bit.
Yeah, and I don't think there's any question. Going to, if you are able to go to the country, and you're able to explore what it is that's happening in someone's kitchen, there is something about the surroundings, the environment, the flavors that you get, an understanding of a culture through their cuisine that's very hard to get from a recipe in a book or online.
Yeah. So, I mean, it reminds me of your French chef sort of showing you exactly how to do something face to face, you know, before that. And it was the same for me when I was a cook. Like, that was the oral tradition of recipe passing on was like alive and well in the kitchen.
As, absolutely.
You know, and now it's just things are codified. All right. I feel like I could talk to you guys forever. It's just the greatest. All right. So lightning round, very straightforward. I'm going to ask you this or that. And it's like forever. Okay, it's like, these are questions I'm saying, you know, it's this or that thing for the rest of your life forever. Which one are you going to choose?
Okay.
Okay? All right, let's start. We'll softball the first one. Oh, this is hard, actually. Tomato or tomatillo?
Tomato.
Tomato.
Tomato. Potato chip or a Frito?
Potato chip. Without a doubt.
I'm Frito all the way.
Oh, my God.
I love them so much. Yeah. A fried fish taco or ceviche?
Ceviche.
Even though you had this story about the fish taco, it was like the seminal moment.
I don't like the fried. Yeah. We'd love a grilled fish taco.
Oh. Okay, cool. Don't tell that to Adam Rappaport. He'll talk your ear off about a grilled fish taco. Pork fat or olive oil?
Olive oil.
Forever. This is forever.
Well, you know me. I always agree with Susan.
Okay, great. And that right there, I think, is the secret to a lasting partnership.
Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You guys are the best. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us. It was a delight.
The Bon Appetit Foodcast is produced by Emma Wertzman and Carrie Polis and edited by Mitra Kaboli. Our theme music is by Valerie and the Gradys, with additional music by Nathaniel Wertzman. We have new episodes every Wednesday, and if you want to tell us about this or any other episode, email us at bonappetitfoodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.